which will be led by Martin Harrison, who we invited to come and give what I know he's reluctantly acknowledged to be the keynote. But in calling in that, it reflects the key position that Martin occupies currently as editor of the ongoing production of the catalogue Raisonné that Martin is working on, but also acknowledgement of the work he's already done, which has already been referred to in the session before. You have his biography in front of you, so I'm not going to dwell on it too much longer. But the format will be that Martin will come up and speak for about 45 minutes, and then Andrew Brighton will respond, and then the two of them will move into a discussion and open to you for questions. Andrew Brighton, we're delighted to welcome back here at Tate, particularly for me, who's my predecessor but one before my job. Again, Andrew has been referred to, has also published on Francis Bacon, and since we're into the habit of marketing all our various publications, Martin's works are too big to actually hold up and promote, but you do have the opportunity after we finish this session to move upstairs and have the unique opportunity of looking at the exhibition as a very small number, and also to coincide to mark the launch of Martin's latest publication, Incunabula, which will be on sale upstairs as well. But also Andrew Brighton's much smaller book will also be on display. So without further ado, I'm going to invite Martin to come to the lectern and take us on.
Well, as always with these conferences, already what's gone before leads me to want to react to and discuss certain things within the framework of what's been established. And David's excellent first setting of a framework, by his definition, I guess I'm a profaner. And to relate to a question that was raised in discussion at the end there, I'd be the first person who wouldn't have published anything if Bacon were alive. I'm conscious of that. One's always aware of it, and it's a slightly difficult position. And also relating to something that was raised, I am to be the curator of an exhibition in 2 years' time at the Hermitage in Russia, or beginning there anyway, on Bacon's late paintings. And the enthusiastic young curator from the Hermitage, Dmitry Ozukov, our first meeting said, "Well, yes, of course, we want these Muybridges and Deakins in the show." I said, "To hell with that. We're not having any of that archive stuff in my show." Which since then you may say, well, why does this fellow do books that seem to relate to it? And I really always want to make the distinction. Hence, beginning with this slide, it's not really part of my talk, but I always feel I should preface my talks with a plea for, really, I do understand that Francis Bacon was a painter, not a photographer, not a collector of magazine cuttings, as he referred to very early on in that. It's true we have very little in terms of Bacon's writing, not many very important letters, and one of the most important, if not the most, was published by Martin Hammer in his Bacon and Sutherland book, The Letter to Sonia Orwell in 1954, which I shall refer to later, where he makes it very plain he's not just a collector of magazine clippings, he's a painter. I'm always conscious of that, but always feel I have to make that distinction. Not least also because today, this show's been on a little while now, this terrific show at the Tate, and Elizabeth Beattie at the State of Francis Bacon office, I don't take any newspapers, but she kindly passes on photocopies of the things that the estate's press cutting service sent to her. So I've seen many reviews of this exhibition and have become conscious that, well, at least a third, I would say, are very sniffy about the archive section. And it seems to be a problem for them, as though they feel it undermines Bacon, although that's a very profane thing to do. I mean, that they are people of the genius stature of Rachel Campbell Johnson, another journalist, it's true, but nonetheless, they do seem to raise problems for them. My main answer to that would be, and when you look at a great Bacon painting like this, it's not part of the show, although it was certainly part of Richard and Andrea's show, as you may have noticed. I regard this as perhaps Bacon's first great portrait of an individual from his circle. And it, in a way, it's an intense colour, the energy, the movement of the paint, the life of the paint being equivalent to the life of the sitter. You can almost feel Muriel Belcher being here now. And in Bacon's great phrase, it has all the pulsations of that person. In the presence of such great paintings, why would we not be more curious to know how he made them, why he made them, why he painted what he did? Hence, in a way, the archives section. It might, and I'll hope to show something of that later, explain some of those questions, partly at least. I'm just talking about two things today. One, we broadly speaking call iconography, and the other is a sort of disguise book plug a bit for Incunabula. I certainly don't want to plug it, but I try to explain what many people don't understand that I've spoken to, what the point of the book is in a way, and why I do think in a way some of the topics it raises at least, it's not to say I've dealt with it correctly, but some of the topics it raises are of importance to Bacon's studies. Because I regard those preliminary works, those archive materials, that they're what I regard as Bacon's preliminary studies, to make a slight leap, if you like, his drawings. So my second topic will be Bacon's drawings. And here's another drawing by Bacon, as I regard it. I don't think anyone's seen this. I only know it from a photograph from Marlborough's archives. Unless someone can correct me, I'm not sure this is known where it is at the moment anyway. It's a piece of writing, I think, probably from the late 1950s by Bacon. And in my really amateur PowerPoint way, I've put little blue stars on the three times in such a short piece, about six lines, he's talking about the formation of a painting, which perhaps didn't happen as he wrote it down. This was a preliminary study in words here. But he's used the word photograph in it three times. First of all, a photograph of his own painting, the self-reference being one of the most important Bacon sources, of course. If you've had a chance to read it, could it be that or something like it, which might help date the writing? It would presumably before this. I don't know. I sort of just went through the Ali Rothenstein catalogue resume and thought, well, what on earth could this refer to? Man on couch, arm on rail, hand raised. Well, it might be this. Well, to begin then, after that circuitous non-beginning, on my first visit to the exhibition here at the Tate, and that is in a way my framework, and this topic's again been brought up this afternoon already, I was most struck instantly, almost on entering, by that wonderful room with the four crucifixions, but in my case, most especially, the 1962 and 1965 crucifixions. These, in a way, I'm going to interrupt myself and just say, something that just was brought up at the end there in the discussion. For me, it's a very useful, rough and ready distinction to make. I mean, it's just as I use it, but I find it useful. Bacon really did two sorts of paintings, the portraits, which I think are hugely important, and miss some of the questions about narrative or the anecdotal, just by virtue of being what they are. And the subject paintings, as I call them. And my subject is the subject paintings and the iconography thereof. And I'm just going to start with the other great crucifixion in that room, the 1965 crucifixion. Some of this is quite quick. I've already published in camera the relationship between the Muybridge figure on the left there, which he blacks out and transposes into the left panel of the painting here. And I wouldn't really bore you with repeating it necessarily, except that it only occurred to me, I was looking at it closely on that first visit, and I have done three or four more times since then to the Tate. Wait a minute, I know a picture of this. It doesn't look the figure surveying the body shot about on a bed, as Bacon called it. It doesn't look like that. And the painting, as the previous caption showed, was made in 1965. And I realized that in the Bacon archives, we have the image on the left here, which shows the painting in an earlier state. I'm not showing you these because they're necessarily earth-shatteringly important, but I think that no one here will know these things, so I'm just sharing some stuff. But it may be the colour shift is just a thing of photography. There's no real change in the colour. You're working from different old transparencies, and you just can't regularise them in the same way. But the figure on the left is the first version. I don't think we know yet exactly what month in 1965 it was produced, but by February 1967, not long after, it was sold to Munich, in the museum where it still is. And I'll come back to that point in a second. So he changed it within, say, 18 months or so of having painted it. And I wonder if, because I was lucky enough on my first visit to the show to come in the day before it opened with Francis's sister, Ianthe, and she made a remark, which I'll come back to in a moment, which may have some bearing on this. But you see some minor and then not so minor changes that is made, which are quite interesting, the sort of linkage of the feet here. What first looks like a drip of black paint across the breast here, which I took to be perhaps an accident, but when you look at it in the gallery again, it doesn't look so accidental. But in the left-hand version, the head seems to be absolutely upside down in a typically Baconic way, and a wild haircut that I have no explanation for. Whereas here, she looks quite like, in a way, she's been made almost into one of his representations of Henrietta Moray, as you might say, and she seems to be surveying the body shot to pieces on a bed. I mean, you could spend all day and more just talking about this one painting, and I'm not going to go over ground that the various components of the iconography of this painting, which have been well covered elsewhere. Again, this is published in my essay in the Tate catalogue. I mean, in many ways, the most amazing transposition, I think, of all the ones Bacon made, of this detail from a photograph by the young Jacques-Henri Lartigue, which he almost certainly saw in Life magazine, not long before making the painting. It was published there. Lartigue was by then an old man, but his fame came much later in life, really in the 1960s, mostly in New York at first. And the pictures he took as a teenager, like the one on the left with his focal plane shutter, only started to be published and available then. And Francis was clearly intrigued and in the strangest possible way used it for the figures at a kind of bar in the right panel of the painting. To jump from that to a psychologistic reading of him, it's Lartigue's father driving the car, and it's known very well, of course, so I'm sure to all of you, that Bacon had problems with his father. That may or may not be significant in his choice of the image, I don't know, but I'll return to a similar statement later on. In doing the research for Incunabula, the image on the left had always intrigued me. It's one from the collection in the Hugh Lane in Dublin, and it's clearly a very tattered image torn from a magazine, paint spattered and so on, which at some clearly later date, Francis seemed to feel fond enough of that he decided to preserve it in that state by mounting it on some card. The piece of brown card is the way he dealt with it. And he did seem to, he did that with favored, I assume, favored images. He prolonged their life, perhaps usually when they're already damaged, by turning them into these almost talismanic things as you find them now on pieces of card, often the back hard covers of books torn off and used as a piece of card and stuck onto those. The first clue in the way in which you do this kind of forensic research was the typography just folded over there. You're always wanting to look at the verso sides of things you're not allowed to because, of course, they're glued down and they're museum objects. Couldn't we get the kettle out while they're not looking? You know, it looked like the Sunday Times, and yet the trouble was the coloured photographs of Hitler and the Nazis were really not, if you look at the bibliographies, weren't supposed to have been published until 1971. So our search was really from 1971 onwards, which was a red herring. This was in fact, which is why it took so long to find, in fact this image is from the third ever colour supplement, the third Sunday Times colour supplement at the beginning of 1962. And that's the only surviving fragment from it in Dublin. at the top, so what I always do then is buy the book or magazine. We've been buying hundreds all through the year. Everything that he used, and perhaps there's a tiny fragment of in Dublin, one goes to the original. Because Bacon, the cover-up man, is not necessarily, and he's not here for my benefit or any other oddballs like me anyway, he may not have preserved a much more important piece from the same source. And if you buy the Sunday Times colour supplement from 1962, you will see among about 10 photographs included, and it is the one at the top right here of Hitler with his entourage, which is surely almost certainly a painting that a source that Bacon actually referred to in one of the interviews of the time. I shall come to it in a second. I put this talk together ages ago because I knew how busy I was in the time running up to it, and at that time hadn't read Matthew's text in the Tate catalogue. So when I finally did, people looked at me askance when I suggested that in the detail here at the bottom right from the 1965 crucifixion looks just like Hitler to me. Well, Matthew said exactly the same thing in the catalogue, so we're agreed on that for what it's worth. And there obviously is a Nazi theme to this, as is evident from especially the right panel of the painting. And finding the magazine that Bacon tore the fragment from led one to the photograph of Hitler, and I would think that is indeed the image of Hitler that Bacon, as I said, referred to at the time when he said, "I was looking at that time at some coloured photographs I had of Hitler standing with his entourage," and he was talking about the source of the swastika. And this caused, of course, something of a furore at the time. It wasn't considered terribly nice to show people with swastikas in paintings in the 1960s. And Bacon, I think, became slightly embarrassed by it. And it's rather like John Lennon in America causing all the fuss when he said they were bigger than Jesus. And there were slightly awkward, slightly pulling backs from that position, though he really didn't want to. And I think it was something similar with Bacon. But when we went into the gallery on the Sunday before the show, the first thing Ianthe, Francis's sister, said was, "Oh, he had to change that because it was being sold in Germany." Well, I didn't know that, and it didn't necessarily seem to stand up. But you'll notice in the final version, which this is, he's somewhat muted the swastika. If you go and look at it in the gallery, it's paled off a bit. In comparison with, in fact, I'm doing the same thing. On the left, you have the first version of the right panel of that triptych, and the quite radical changes this time. I mean, again, there's a difference, which is photography, not the actual painting. But nonetheless, I think you can see it is stronger, the swastika, on the original version. This is absolute speculation, because this is new information to me. But I would suggest perhaps as he toned it down a little bit as a compromise, because it's being sold to Germany and with the obvious political sensitivities. I don't know. He's changed the rosette. Now, what is the significance of that rosette? I mean, is it a rosette on meat? Is it the French tricolour? Are we going back to Napoleon here? Is he talking about wars? I don't know. But, of course, the pedestal on which he stands in schematic form here in the left panel is radically changed here on the left. On the right, I'm sorry. And, of course, the raw canvas that you can see there was, I mean, the painting was sent out and photographed like this, and exactly at what date before it arrived in Munich in 1967 that it was changed, I don't yet know. There's nothing recorded in Marlborough's archives about it, I can confirm that. So the Discobolus figure, as I like to call it here, has been changed from one to the other. This is incidentally the first time that this appeared in Bacon's iconography, the Discobolus figure, and it was repeated many, many times, sometimes in the center of triptychs, for example, later on. Well, you'll have noticed that already I've been edging towards territories that are antithetical to the theories of, say, Gilles Deleuze and even up to a point Michel Léris. But what I call the non-narrative, just abstract sensation school of thought was established long before their writings in any case. In the current issue of Tate, etc., the Tate's House magazine, is a long piece by Linda Nochlin, the American art historian, for which I've just taken this extract, and she is addressing, I mean, she alone in that, and she still quite rarely among art historians writing today is addressing the question of, if you like, Bacon having an iconography. does he have a, do the subject paintings, as I call them, have a subject matter? And does believing that or recognizing it or looking at it undermine Bacon as the painter of sensations? Well, and she brings in again that Richard raised this point briefly just at the end of the previous session about religious triptychs and Christian art. And it may come up during the conference. I don't want to pursue that at the moment. She added to this piece, anti-narrative defensiveness is understandable enough in the context of the heady days of abstract expressionism, in brackets, which Bacon ostensibly hated, but which obviously exerted a certain seductive power on his formal language. Newsweek in 1963, at the time of the first major Bacon exhibition in America at the Guggenheim, curated by Lawrence Alloway, the great English art historian whose name's come up more than once already this afternoon, Newsweek described the show thus: Bacon places grisly events in the bright-colored nothingness of abstract painters like Rothko and Newman. In Incunabula, I've always, since being young, and it's a long time ago, been a huge fan of Ed Reinhardt. You couldn't imagine Bacon saying, if you know, have read any of his comments on American abstract expressionists, you thought he might have reserved some of his rudest for Ed Reinhardt, though I've never read any comments. So it was fascinating to find in the material in Dublin this page torn from a book showing Ed in his studio, and Bacon's obviously roughed out these two semicircles on it and spattered bits of paint. I put it next to this detail from the 1962 Three Studies for a Crucifixion, only because maybe those formal planes of black and red here have some kind of relationship. I'm not really saying they do, and I haven't found anything that linked in with that image on the left. Most of these things are openings up of inquiry, which has to be done. Rebecca Daniels and myself, our job was to identify the source of those works. Nothing else. The next stage is the next stage. And that's, of course, potentially much more exciting. But also mindful of the fact that Roth goes on at the other Tate at the moment, and the comment from the men in Newsweek. I've got a little Rothko section here. Bacon, in one of the David Sylvester interviews, but it's not one of the ones published in the main body, it was kept back, one wonders why, and then published in the last book that David produced, looking back at Francis Bacon after Francis's death, when he put in a section, an addendum sort of section of comments, and a very useful appendix of comments made by Bacon about various subjects, including about other artists, ancient and modern. And Bacon said about Rothko, the big Rothko retrospective at the Whitechapel Art Gallery in London in 1961, which clearly he went to see, I hoped to see marvelous abstract turners, but instead I saw just rather dismal variations on color. That was his put down of Rothko. I mean, that's pretty much all that was said. It's like when he was always calling Pollock the old lace maker, and he did a whole roster of rude comments about abstract contemporaries. However, on the left here is a painting. I've discussed this in part before, and it's a really ongoing thing. Painting 1950 by Bacon in Leeds Art Gallery on the left. I did show it in a short talk once related to a couple of Rothkos, and no one seemed very convinced, so I'll try it again. There in the middle is some early color field Rothko when he reached his maturity, and it's got these sort of evanescing planes, not a million miles away from the formal arrangement of that Bacon, which, I mean, in camera I discussed, I think, Matisse and classical statuary and all sorts of possible sources, and there's Michelangelo, of course, for parts of it. But it's the color and the formal arrangement. If you look at that wonderful, gosh, I've forgotten the author, the wonderful sort of semi-catalogue resume of Rothko, that big fat Thames and Hudson book, on a page near where the Rothko in the middle, the untitled painting, is reproduced, is, if you turn it around 90 degrees, that Matisse-like stripy colored background in the shower or wherever it is in that painting, there's a Rothko which is actually incredibly like it as well. How, though, could Bacon in London, and I see a lot of young people here, and it doesn't stop you knowing about ancient history, but I don't know how au fait you'd be with the situation in London just after the war, there was a dearth of good art magazines, no big coloured glossy art magazines like we've been used to in the last 20 or 30 years. No colour reproduction at all in the art magazines. Very little information about American painting. And Rothko, Still, Klein, Pollock, they weren't the huge names they are now, most certainly not in England. And the only source, and I did really comb everything because I'm a very strange person like this, the only thing published before Bacon painted that painting was the American edition of Vogue, the issues dated there, which showed that Rothko there on the right. The only thing he could have got hold of. Except that, for what it's worth, Bacon made that painting in September 1950. Mark Rothko was in London on his first ever visit to Europe, heading back, broke by then, having been around Italy in all the right places. And he was in London, his biography says, for 3 or 4 weeks in August 1950. Bacon painted the painting the next month, and I have nothing more to say on the subject. But let's think of them together in Cromwell Place discussing colour field and what Clement Greenberg would say. Back to Three Studies for a Crucifixion. I'm doing it the wrong way round. The exhibition in Vienna in 2004 was referred to by, I think, David and Chris. And I was at the opening for that, and of course there are very eminent curators, often from museums, who loaned pictures to the exhibition. And this painting was loaned by the Guggenheim. And I took about five, six curators up to it at the opening. You know, you've had a few drinks and you get flippant. And I sort of grabbed them by the arm and said, okay, what's that on the bottom right there? What are those two forms there? How would you read the whole painting? And the answer universally was, do you know, I'd never thought. Do you know, I'd no idea. This kind of is my sort of starting point in a way. Are we really saying, and as the people who want to block off this line of inquiry, that none of the main pictorial elements in this painting mean anything? Are they just accidents, as Bacon would have said, or sensations, as Deleuze would say? Why do they come in this form? Is this a generation? I mean, I love Clifford Still, but they just want stuff dripping down which you can't attach anything to unless you're Robert Rosenblum or someone who wants to talk about abstract sublime and then start reading back into it, like Rosalind Krauss et al. Will tell you what all the bits in a Pollock suddenly mean, and we suddenly see lots of figures after postmodernism in them. It isn't an abstract painting. They're there for a reason, and I really reserve the right myself to try and ask what they're saying. What Bacon thought they were saying, what I think he thought they were saying, what I think they are saying. And I don't have any particular answers except to plug my point of view and my approach. Maybe some suggestions. So looking at the left panel here, which I won't leave this for a moment, and on the right, well, it says it's Ratapoile by Daumier. Now, Ratapoile is just a small figurine with this corkscrew movement, this wound-up tension. Bacon loved Daumier. All of these things may have appealed. Ratapoile is a made-up name, as Christophe Dejean kindly told me. Rata, as in ratatouille, just a mixture, a skin mixture. It's just a construction of Daumier's, and it was meant to indicate a kind of hired political bully in the Louis-Napoleon period who went around bullying people to vote the right way. Well, Daumier, of course, is a great caricaturist and a very politically committed figure as a Republican, an anti-monarchist, would have a dim view of Ratapoile, therefore. I've always wondered what the figure on the right here in Bacon's painting could possibly mean. And I used to read this thing on the top as a Venetian mask, which, whatever it is, no one ever, to my knowledge, ever discussed what any of the bloody thing meant, apart from a thing I'll come on to in a minute. Well, it either is or isn't, but the squashed cap on Ratapoile, as sculpted by Daumier here, is very like it in form. I don't think it's meant to be a Venetian mask, but I see similarities between that and what Bacon's doing here. You have to remember that, I think it's in my essay for the Tate's catalogue, I discussed John Rothenstein saying that Bacon usually would look at exhibitions at the Tate at a period of great closeness between the director of the Tate and author of the Bacon catalogue, Resin A, and Bacon himself. He would usually come in, he would pick, in a way which sounds absolutely true of Bacon, one or two things, concentrate and go. he'd immediately hit on the paintings, whatever the show was. The single exception was the Daumier exhibition here, where he looked at everything long and hard, and that was 1961. Well, the painting's 1962, so the chronology, Bacon's painting, so the chronology is working. I made this slide from a copy of a Milan catalogue of Daumier, and notice even the red background, coincidence, I mean, it's just the way a photographer did it. And all I can say is it belonged to Miss Beston, Valerie Beston's Bacon's gallerist. It's not found in Dublin, and I don't know that Bacon had it, but as a huge fan of Daumier, that his gallerist had the catalogue at her death, I think is interesting. I was plugging the Daumier point in my text, and no one writes in to say how convinced they are, so I'm going to keep on pushing it with another one just before I go. Oh, look, it's self-explanatory. Of course he was looking at Daumier, lots and lots. So back to Three Studies as a whole. Since my Tate essay, I've been to New York and have read the other side of the correspondence in the archives at the Museum of Modern Art, the correspondence that I quote in the Tate catalogue between Bacon, or his London spokesman, and James Thrall Sobey, the curator at MoMA, who in the 1950s was planning what would have been the first monograph on Bacon. And I found some interesting letters, which are, as it were, on the New York side, which aren't here, and since I imagine no one has ever read them, I'm going to read a couple of bits which are pertinent to my topic today. David Sylvester, who's, of course, completely wonderful and our other great art historian, in my opinion, of the post-war period, and had written many, many wonderful things, so I suppose he's allowed to write in this manner, but rather unimpressed by Sobey's eminence in New York, anyway. It looks like the hegemony wasn't quite working in the way it was supposed to there. He seemed to regard them as bloody Yanks, and you know from the correspondence on the other side, they were appalled by the behavior of the British and how unhelpful we were. And they seem rather elegant and nice patrician Americans who were very respectable and sweet and very upset by the treatment they got. But anyway, Sobey's first text that he sent to Bacon as a sort of introduction to this book, which Bacon absolutely hated, and it effectively stopped the book. But before it did finally stop it, in 1962, some letters were going back and forth, trying to perhaps to rescue the situation. David pulled it apart, fascinatingly, piece by piece. Every single thing he didn't like, he told Sobey where he'd gone wrong. And here's a quotation then from Sylvester to Sobey in 1962. "Your remarks about Panofsky show a complete misunderstanding of the kind of artist Bacon essentially is. Of course, Panofsky might well despair if he were foolish enough to try to interpret Bacon in the way that you do. His kind of iconological analysis consists of interpreting intentional symbols. Such an approach is entirely irrelevant to Bacon." So David, whom, like anyone who knew him, I adored and greatly respect. So I am really ignoring what David said there. But you see, I think he said it. He and Alloway, our two great critics of that period, were absolutely enthralled to American abstract painting. And I think it slightly colored their views. And I think they had to twist themselves to find a way through to how do we deal with these paintings by Bacon? Bacon broke all of the rules. He was a one-off. And, of course, he was much greater than any of the guys who they're enthralled to. That's clear to you all. Sorry. Sorry, Pollock fans. I mean, but, you know, he just did not fit with their theoretical framework. He really didn't. And this is part of the greatness of Bacon. I mean, his courage, or whatever you want to call it, that he stood in the face of all that from the Second World War onwards. Lawrence Alloway in Art News in 1957 about the connection between Velázquez and Van Gogh had already said, had written, it was precisely a taking possession of known images and personalizing them, what Bacon did. He is the reverse of someone who makes aesthetic refinements only Whistler could appreciate, or iconographical allusions only Panofsky can understand. This is the young generation kicking daddy, don't forget, of art historians. They were young men then. They're kicking Panofsky too. Don't forget this. Those of you who are in touch with your British post-war art history in a broader sense. And John Russell, in that wonderful little book he did, published by Methuen in 1964, spoke about today's canting explanations of what Bacon is about. And he talks about invoking all the old masters for comparison and so on. But question is then, does, as Bacon worried to John Russell, and Russell quoted, the story talk louder than the paint? Comes back to that first slide of Muriel Belcher. Is this story talking louder than the paint? The paint's great. What's so special about the paint? I mean, are you going to go all day say, look at the way he flicked the brush there? Isn't that a bit limited? Can't you have both? Does the story talk louder than the paint in a Titian or a Raphael or a Caravaggio? Can't you have both? To go back to what Andrea quoted from Bacon's text on Matthew Smith, or idea and technique inseparable. Bacon advocated that. Couldn't you have the idea being part of the idea being, the, as it were, the iconography? This was interpreted at the time in various ways, and Harry Fisher from Bacon's gallerist at Marlborough was trying to be helpful to Sobey. He could never get through to Bacon. He kept trying to see him. Bacon put him off, and he was conveying questions and answers. He's in a sort of intermediary, as were David Sylvester and Robert Melville, who David mentioned at the beginning today, all acting on Sobey's behalf. All these people wanted this book, and so did Marlborough, to happen, and Bacon wasn't really being cooperative. Magnificently uncooperative, in fact. I mentioned in the Tate catalogue that Harry Fisher, in all good faith, had spoken to Bacon, and Bacon had said, "Oh, the two figures on the left are Hitler and Himmler shoving Jews into the gas oven." While Harry Fisher was Jewish, this is Bacon being mischievous, naughty, crude, whatever you want to say, making what sounds like an anti-Semitic reference to his Jewish dealer. Sometimes Bacon was witty. Sometimes he's just being amusing. You may think it's not a joke in good taste, but Harry Fisher didn't sack him because of it. These were readings that weren't at all popular, and of course that one was completely dismissed by David Sylvester as just sort of a nonsense comment. Michael Pepiat's autobiography, it was a point taken entirely from the Danish art historian Rolf Lessoy's text some 9 years earlier, interpreted as this. It's Bacon's father on the left ejecting Bacon, and he's reading that as Bacon on the right of the left panel, from the house, age 16, when he caught Bacon wearing his mother's underclothes, and that's Bacon wearing a body stocking. Now, that is the most, that's the most literal, autobiographically connected piece of iconography you could possibly get. In camera, I said, I thought, well, maybe there's something in it, and I credited it to Pepiat there, not knowing it was taken from Lessoy's text, which is a much longer one on it, in a magazine called Hafnia, if you want to get hold of it, anyone. But you see, Bacon himself had discussed crucifixions, particularly, as being almost nearer self-portraits. Well, that's an interesting remark, and we could talk about that for the rest of the day. And they're about all sorts of very private feelings. Well, I mean, they're private to Jesus Christ, but they're meant to have a meaning then within Christianity. But what did he mean by that? And he'd also talked in one context of these paintings, there's a blurring of imagination and fact. In digging into the iconography or the old-fashioned formal art history of this painting, I've been looking at, well, what can I make of my point? What exactly is my point? What can I make of my point here? And another thing I don't think you'll know is that, well, you will know if you read your Ali Rothenstein. It does say in there that Bacon painted the left panel of the 1962 Three Studies for a Crucifixion, and it was delivered to Marlborough, I think it's the 14th of March, 1962, and it was repainted and redelivered and re-photographed 16 days later. This is the painting where he did say once that it's the only painting he's been able to ever complete while drunk. And he would be, because he knew this was his big moment. This was painted for the first great Tate retrospective. This was the exhibition that was going to finally make this person who gambled lots of money, who's never had anything much to speak of, it was really going to rocket him solidly with Marlborough behind him on the way to international fame. And he had to end it with a killer painting, and this was it, and this is what it was meant to be. Well, it was only photographed in black and white. I'm not being perverse in showing them to you, but you can see that the squares, whatever they are meant to represent in the background, were changed from what looks like white or a very pale color to the painting as you see it now in black in these 2 weeks. The tears here are just what's, it's a very crumpled old glossy black and white that exists of it that I scanned this from. But the head of the man is changed radically too. So Pepiat and Masoi read him as Bacon's grumpy father, throwing him out of the house. Whoever he is, he's been changed in 2 weeks from this bespectacled figure with rather more, or rather differently distorted features. And again, I'm linking that back to a fairly close in many ways. I mean, they're not that was taken that literal, Daumier's source. And again, wouldn't it be resonant for Bacon that he's Daumier's Mr. Odieux, who's his joke on Mr. Odier, and he calls him odious. And if it is his father, Bacon thought his father was odious, so it would fit. But, you know, I'm not pretending that that's a definitive representation of the iconography of the painting at all, but they're just suggestions. Well, I mean, I'm speculating here on a pictorial source which may or may not be bound up with the painting's iconology, to borrow Panofsky's word. But I want to, just before ending this section, dive just a little bit further into the territory banned by people like Ernst van Alphen. And because, that's it. I would contend that, and I've published this in two places already, as for example with the Caravaggio source, again first noticed by David Sylvester, for the right panel of this Bacon triptych, Three Studies for the Human Body, 1970, that identifying the artwork's imagery, in other words, its iconography, or if you like, its source, while it, I don't pretend, and no one would want to, that it unpeels anything like all the layers of the painting's meaning, may lead us toward what Bacon was intending to do with the painting, what he thought he was saying, and therefore what we think he was saying. Now, I can't remember Van Alphen's, he just says it's a figure teetering in mid-space or something, but he's a literary, he's a professor of literature, not painting. Perhaps he doesn't know the Caravaggio, though Bal should have told him, I suppose. Since she writes equally silly books on that. But there's the figure teetering in the abyss there. But Bacon, as I've published before, changes the sex of Narcissus, because that's the Caravaggio it's based on. It's got these pendulous breasts and various other things, and denies Narcissus his reflection. Just to jump back, those astonishing pictures that Richard showed at the end there of the triptychs, the German photography source, is quite fascinating. And someone asked the question about photo booths. I wanted to pick the microphone up there and say, well, I regard the photo booth, when Bacon did his own pictures, isn't that essentially narcissistic? Wouldn't that be a key word for the taking yourself in a photo booth? Isn't that modern photo narcissism personified? And my contention again would be that perhaps understanding its iconography, if you like, may help to clarify what Van Alphen would call the affect of the painting on the viewer. And it strikes me as strange in a way that while we're supposed to live in this now multidisciplinary, pluralistic world of postmodern approaches to art, that avenues are forbidden in any case, like this one is still would be frowned upon by many writers. But, you know, it doesn't have to be some neo-Calvinistic strict order versus everything else. So it's not an either-or. You know, this is only one. I'm not trying to sell this as the only way to look at Bacon. Very far from it. It's just a way. And I think, you could go much deeper into it if we had much longer, but I think if you dug into it, you probably won't learn about the way he manipulated his paintbrush or his rags or anything else, but you might learn something about what it was he was trying to say with the paintings. I think I'm probably going to run late if I digress further down that road. So I'm going to go to part two now, the Bacon and Incunabula. Well, why the book? Chris Stevens asked Rebecca, who worked on the book with me at one of the openings, what on earth's the point of that book? He pretends he didn't say that now, but she reports everything very accurately as she does all the research facts. And... well, I often ask myself, believe me, I wake up in the middle of the night, as my wife will tell you, worrying about just that. It stemmed from this point, and it's Margarita here. She's going to hate me for this, but She's speaking tomorrow, and I got very worried when Vicky Walsh told me she might be here, because I mean, I've nothing against her personally, and she's done great work in Dublin. But this is from her book that came out just after my one 3 years ago. And those of us who didn't have easy access to Dublin were frustrated by not having it. We wanted to get our hands on those 7,500 stunning items they had. But also we were frustrated then by the book, because it came out, and I hope you can read it from there. The caption says, "Date unknown," and it says, "Leaf from unidentified book." So there they are, they've got all the material. So what they're telling you, they've not identified the book that the photograph of the owl here comes from. They don't know the date of it. Well, that struck me as then virtually useless, because if you don't know when the book was published, you haven't got any terminus dates for Bacon having made use of it. And it might be important. And this is not in Incunabula, actually, this particular one, or this page. The great painting, first Bacon painting I ever knew, and I've always adored it, and I still do, landscape near Malabar to Tangier, 1963, is in this show. And I'm sure you've all looked at it and admired it. And like me, puzzled over what the three forms here, you can never read in most reproductions, and you can't on this, that it's clearly a windswept tree at the top right there. But these three forms, I've tried dozens of people, including some Bacon intimates. No one's really got an idea what they are. Well, there's a kind of a bird, there's a kind of a, you know, it's all kind of a, and they're just abstract sensations, but no, they're not, according to me. There are even in the vaunted archives section at the Tate things which have not been corrected from the information in our book. There's a page that says it's from a French magazine. Well, no, it's not. It's from Paris Match, 1978. And if you see the figure with its foot up, kicking the soldier kicking down a door in Zaire, and relate it to the 1978 painting in the show, maybe you've got a connection. And what an interesting thing that year is then, 1978 and 1978. Most of Bacon's Paris Match collecting was much earlier than that. 78, as it were, a late one for him. The date isn't irrelevant. You have to get down to the boring detail to make any use of these things. Well, the point was about this one. Let's get onto this, because I don't get this painting. I love it, and maybe this is a source. It looks quite like it a bit, except that if it means the form in the foreground here, it would have to be laterally reversed, and Bacon very seldom did that with his sources. It would probably mean tracing. Didn't do much tracing. So the painting's 1963. Unfortunately, the book, and take my word for it, that's the book the page was torn from, I mean another copy of, was published in 1964 in America and 1965 in England, i.e. after the painting. There's only one way around that, and I was doing more research in New York, actually, on this. The photographer, Shelley Grossman, who's a man, famous nature photographer, did actually have some photographs published in the Life Nature Library series, and the one on birds should have arrived by today through ABE, but it didn't. They're saying 2 to 5 days now, so I may never be able to show it to you. Whether it's got this image in or not, I don't know. But either way, that page is not the source for that painting, which would mean if it's the source at all, and it was published in the Life book, which I can't prove, in 1963, he kept it, as he often did, as this kind of atavistic reference to his own collecting. Like his collecting of Velázquez shortly before he died, when he stopped painting Pope Innocent in 1965, which is another thing that needs more explanation than we've given it. So we need accurate data, I think. Martin Hammer, as I said, published this most important letter from Bacon to Sonia Orwell in 1954 in his Bacon and Sutherland book. And Chris and Matthew illustrate a perfect copy of this book in their Tate catalogue. And one of the things that Bacon says in this letter to Sonia is he's more or less saying that the book from which this is taken, this is a fragment torn from a page in Dublin, there's a couple of other pages only torn out of the book in the Hugh Lane. He's more or less saying it's the most important source book of all for him. And it's called Il Mondo Cambia. An Italian book published in 1949 by Leo Longanesi, a very interesting person who we could talk about. And there it is. This is the most exciting thing torn out by Bacon, because, of course, it's full of paint spatters, looks worked on, and he's drawn a space frame, and who knows, it might be an early so-called space frame. Who's to know? This is an Austrian internment camp in 1916. And of course, until finding the book, I never knew what it was. And I had all sorts of experts on the First World War and the Boer War telling me when concentration camps were made. And it's very, very difficult. And I mean, just superficially, the wire fence here, does that have anything to do with paintings like Chimpanzee? I don't know. There may be parallels. But the point really is that these weren't objects. The things, the 7,500, or the amount of them that are the what I call the flat art material, things torn from books, magazines, bromide photographs, and there's about 2,000 plus of those in Dublin, they weren't things that he just rather liked and stuck in a scrapbook, like a Victorian gentlewoman or something. I mean, he worked on them, he worked with them and through them. It was quintessentially a physical, a tactile process for him, and a creative dialogue. These were his studies. He didn't draw, as I keep saying. Here's another one. This is a mess. It's three images in a way. And believe me, finding out where they actually came from and the correct editions of the book, you can all go and read it now. It's free, and you'd have to be insane to do this, but that's what we did all here. The Rembrandt is most definitely only from the 1952 edition of Tancred Berenius's wonderful Phaidon book of Rembrandt. And of course, it's a self-portrait, but it's mixed in, tilted at an angle, with an image here of a pianist, and actually slightly folded over is a blues guitarist. And you can see Bacon's blue framework here. I've had to tilt these things to sort of show how they're stuck together. And there are the other two images. They're from A Pictorial History of Jazz, published in 1955. So the earliest year this could have happened was 1955. Well, great, here's Bacon, physical, tactile, working with these objects, really working towards paintings that you might see in the late 1950s, and you could start making some comparisons if we'd got time. It's Lead Belly at the bottom, and Papa Jimmy Yancey at the top. Is it, though, a coincidence? It's a Rembrandt self-portrait. Bacon was clear all throughout his life and interviews that he was the greatest self-portraitist, and in many ways he was one of the great artists he most admired. But what's Papa Jimmy Yancey? He's a pianist. What was Peter Lacy, Bacon's love of his life? A pianist. Is it a coincidence? That's my wife thought of that one. It's while I'm asleep and falling apart and going insane, she thinks of the good stuff. Well, there's a terminus arquo date of this of 1955, therefore. So we could start to relate it to paintings later in the 50s. On the left, pages messed around, stuck, clipped, torn, folded from a book, an interesting book in many ways for Bacon, How to Judge Character from the Face, the 1952 exhibition by a Frenchman who lived in England called Jacques Ponry. He actually invented the photo fit as first used by Scotland Yard in 1970 on a crime case. But Bacon here, you see, has put an eye at right angles to the other eye, and it's clipped, it's folded, it's paint spattered, it's clearly very worked on. And I'm not for one moment making a direct connection with this intriguing series of 1960s portraits, the Men with Glasses series, but there may be. Matthew wrote very interestingly in one of his texts in the Tate's catalogue about the connection with Picasso and the 1962 Three Studies for a Crucifixion, and Bacon actually saying in the first interview with David Sylvester that he's about to go back to Picasso and do more with certain unexplored avenues for which Picasso is useful. And I'm sure Matthew's right to relate it to what I would call the subject paintings, but for a start, none of Bacon's portraits of this kind could have ever occurred without Picasso and analytical cubism anyway, in the whole sense of the whole 20th century. But I wonder if also, because this is when the great portraits that were the main focus of that great Edinburgh show started to emerge. I mean, they begin before that, but they really begin seriously around 62-3, this sort of date. And so maybe Picasso is playing into this as well. Just to finish by showing, I mean, my other point I keep banging on about now, and this emerged initially through discussions largely with Agnes Zauner, who made the facsimiles for the Detritus book. She had totally accurate facsimiles of Bacon source materials from Dublin to suddenly play with, because they were just facsimiles. So the process of folding along the lines Bacon had made in them very clearly started. I don't think this is one that Agnes did, I just picked this one out. If you go through the material in Dublin, dozens of the things have these same diagonals that you see here. And clearly they're to a